Welcome to Current State. Mark Bayshore is on vacation. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Michigan State boasts a great roster of Spartans in Hollywood. Arts and Letters alumnus Bill Mechanic's new film, Hacksaw Ridge, got some great buzz at the Vienna Film Festival, and a special on-campus premiere is in the works. It's the story of a World War II conscientious objector who won the Congressional Medal of Honor, and it's already getting Oscar buzz. On the program today, Jamie Paisley talks with Spartan senior Elise Conklin, an honest-to-goodness Oscar winner, for a documentary she helped create that's generating its own energy across the nation. This weekend's Wisconsin game will be a 12 noon start, so the aroma of charcoal will be wafting across campus early in the day on Saturday. What's your favorite tailgate treat? MSU executive chef Kurt Kwiatkowski will join us with some tips on how to maximize good taste in a small space when he talks with Current State's Russ White about tailgate cuisine. And independent investment is nothing new to WKAR listeners. From the beginning, public broadcasting has depended in large measure on the largesse of men and women of vision who believe in the mission and the magic we make on the air. After more than a decade of disinvestment in higher education by the state of Michigan, philanthropy is more important than ever here at MSU. We'll talk about how people like you and me contribute toward Michigan State's margin of excellence with Vice President for University Advancement, Bob Groves. That's all ahead today on Current State here on WKAR. Well, it's fair to say that the pinnacle of filmmaking recognition is winning an Oscar, and those are typically handed out in late February, early March. However, one Michigan State University senior, Elise Conklin, is in Los Angeles this week to pick up her own Academy Award. It's for a film she worked on at MSU, the subject of which has been making headlines across the country. Current State's Jamie Paisley talked with her about the film.
We created a film called From Flint, Voices of a Poisoned City for the documentary capstone class last semester. It's been sent kind of everywhere. It recently got into the Traverse City Film Festival where it was screened. It was accepted into the Chicago International Social Change Film Festival. We've gotten into a couple, and some of them I'm not allowed to publicly say yet, and I'm trying to remember which one's which. Yeah. Our trailer got into the Spartan Film Festival, so that was very exciting to have something here on the home turf.
We're not just looking at Flint. We're looking at our entire state.
And right, but no other state was poisoned by policy.
Detroit Water and Sewage Department had been supplying Flint with cleanest drinking water on the planet for 50 years.
As we're talking about the film, the thing that's coming up next week, where are you heading? Which feels like it should be bittersweet because, yes, it's a really big award, but there's a lot of heavy real-life drama that you've associated with this documentary.
Yeah, so absolutely.
Does it kind of split you in two different directions?
It's really weird to go dress shopping and kind of look at all these price tags and think, should I be spending, you know, this much money on, and even if it isn't like $100 ball gown or whatever to go to the actual Oscars. Like, we're going to the Student Academy Awards and there are some red carpet events and ComArts is helping us pay for plane tickets and stuff. And I keep looking at all the charges and I'm thinking, that's a lot of money. And I mean, to a student, $5 is a lot of money, but it's really, really strange to kind of see how the focus has shifted from not necessarily the film, but more the filmmakers, and we really want to make sure that it is still on Flint and the Flint water crisis. But we are very blessed and very fortunate, especially from a school not from California and not a film school, but our film From Flint was selected as a medalist. We're officially a winner of the Student Academy Awards. We don't know which award we've won yet. We won't know until the 22nd, but we're holding with bated breath and thinking gold thoughts.
Yeah. So for this project From Flint, traditionally a director works very much hand-in-hand with their producer for this one, which is Liv Larson?
Yes.
So talk us through how this project started with working with Liv.
I'm not really sure how, in comparison to a traditional documentary setup, because it was so much a team effort. Like, even she's credited as our gaffer, but Jenna Ange was... she was just our workhorse. She did everything and anything that she could get her hands on. She was making sure that everything was running as smoothly as possible. And we were all very much in that mindset. Like, we would get our job done and then we would move on to anything else that needed to be done because we were working on a very tight schedule with just the five of us pretty much constantly last semester. But Liv and I actually got really close. She is insane. Probably I would wake up to like 40 texts at 3 a.m. and she's like, okay, this is all the things that's happened. Get these on your schedule. Make sure that all this stuff can happen. Who's ready to get the equipment? Making sure everything was running as smoothly as possible. So Liv and I got really close. The way I met her, we were both in the capstone class, and she and our director of photography pitched the idea of doing a film on Flint. And I actually was really intimidated by that idea. Like, I didn't want to go in there and make some student film about how, oh, look how we're helping Flint. We didn't want to do anything like that. And I was a little intimidated that, you know, maybe if we approach this wrong, it could be actually detrimental to the people of Flint, which is something that I expressed and I voiced my concerns. But we were very much aware of those problems and any of the perceptions that might be had, like, oh, here are these kids trying to make, you know, make it big and take advantage of this story. So we talked about that a lot and made sure that the people that we interviewed were people in Flint experiencing these problems, and that we didn't have any leading questions. We didn't want to have a political angle or a political spin. And Liv was amazing at making sure that we were just walking that fine line of making sure that the Flint voices were being heard, but they were saying what they needed to say and what they wanted to say, and we weren't putting an agenda behind it.
Yeah. You brought in somebody that's a state representative as well in the film, Ed McBroom, who represents the 108th, I believe it is.
Detail. They should have been concerned about the public health issues. I don't think any of them were somehow bad people who were trying to do something bad. I think they just didn't take their job seriously enough.
Ed was actually kind of a funny story because our editor had already worked with him because she is a documentarian but works specifically, her major is plant biology. So she works on a lot of stuff involving agriculture, and he is, if you can't see in our interview, but he's wearing cowboy boots, like very much like kind of at home on a farm kind of guy. And the 108th district is in the UP. So it was really interesting to see how involved he was in the Flint water crisis once it broke and once there was a call for, you know, government help, how he was willing to come down and help out, even though he's from the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah.
So Lauren kind of reached out to him and she's like, you know, I know a guy and maybe he'll be down. And it was really nice to get a Republican voice in there as well, because unfortunately or not, I mean, a lot of us are a little bit more leaning towards the Democratic mindset as college students. It's just they're kind of speaking a little bit more toward us. Like Liv Larson is still diehard Bernie Sanders fan. But it was really nice to get a Republican voice so that we would show that this isn't a political stunt. We don't want to push an, like again, I didn't want to push an agenda either, like Democratic or Republican. It was very much just like Flint needs help no matter who you are. So it was really great to have Ed on board and talking about how he could help and what his story was specifically. But it really wasn't intimidating because he's the nicest guy. It was so cool to just kind of sit there and chat with him before and after the interview because he was very, very involved and was also very much like, if you need anything, let me know, let my staff know. I actually don't know if he's been able to see a copy of the film, but I know he sent, I think, two people from his office to come and watch the film when we had the premiere in Studio C.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is in juxtaposition to a moment that happens in the film, which happens not in Flint, but over here in Lansing. You went to some sort of forum that happened at the Avenue, which is on Michigan Avenue, that kind of venue. And I could tell that you were just at the moment of what, in this moment, you're filming somebody from Crossing Waters, that project, and then you hear the voice of somebody screaming.
And how this is targeted predominantly black communities. You talk about you got some policies, I haven't heard one peep about resisting the absolute...
Let me answer your question, okay? We appreciate what you're saying, and we agree with you.
Talk us through that moment.
That was actually our first shoot that we had ever organized. So I didn't really know any of the team yet. We were kind of still trying to figure out what we wanted to say and what our aesthetic was. And Liv and I, if you look really closely, you can see us very far in the back, like scribbling notes as the speech was happening. And then this man who is ironically, I mean, he's in East Lansing, so a relatively well-off white man talking about institutionalized racism, which is definitely a problem, but maybe he wasn't necessarily, it seemed relatively hypocritic coming from his mouth, because he's accusing Michael Hood of not helping the people that needed help most in Flint, which is actually what Crossing Water does. But Michael was very careful not to push an agenda because he is not African-American. He is not from that community, and he doesn't want to speak for that community. He wants to speak for Flint, which is a predominantly African-American city. But again, it's kind of walking that fine line of trying to make sure that everything that's being said is what Flint needs to be said, but we aren't there to push an agenda or, you know, give a voice to someone that we don't necessarily represent. So when this man started yelling, all of us just kind of froze, and our director of photography was actually getting an establishing shot from the outside of the building, and he just hears screaming, and we have the shot where he opens the door and is like, what's going on? And pans up to see this man, and I think Michael puts it the best, because we actually asked him about it in our interview, and he talks about how obviously people are angry, and he doesn't begrudge anyone for their anger, and neither do I. I mean, I think that anger in response to the Flint water crisis is one of the very understandable emotions that a lot of people have. Like, how could this have happened? How are we able to see this? And it is affecting a lot of African American people. So it's clearly aggravating, but it's also really difficult to try and go in and help people. And then even though you're there to help, you can be accused of being racist or being there because you're going to go home to your nice house with running water that you can drink, and then you're gonna go to sleep and you're going to be able to sleep easy. But Michael was very much a part of the philosophy that he did not sleep easy. You could tell that this crisis took a very hard toll on him. So seeing this man accuse Michael of, you know, not necessarily representing or helping the people in Flint that needed it, you could tell that that hurt him, but he doesn't begrudge anyone that anger.
We're speaking with MSU senior Elise Conklin about the documentary she directed called From Flint, Voices from a Poisoned City. The 25-minute documentary is also recipient of a Student Academy Award, which you're accepting later this week in Los Angeles, and the majority of the interview subjects in From Flint were adults. But in the final film, you do have a segment where you spoke with a little girl, one who even wrote a letter to and prompted a visit from President Obama back in May, as well as even just a few days ago popped up in a widely shared photo, which even hit the front page of the website Reddit, a photo with Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump. Tell me about meeting Little Miss Flint.
We were fortunate enough to meet Mari on a total hoax. She was wearing her Little Miss Flint sash, and she was just the cutest thing I'd ever seen in my life. But it was a rally that we went to film, but to also participate in. And we spoke down, we kneeled down and just started kind of talking to her organically. And while Liv was conducting the interview, I asked her mother, like, is it okay if she's on camera? And her mom's like, oh God, she's been on every camera. It's completely fine. So we were able to interview her and speak to her more about, like, what's it actually like being a child in that situation. But this was before she had written the note to Obama, and clearly before she met Donald Trump. But she is fearless and very, very intelligent, even though she is so young, and very aware of the problems.
Some people in my class that they asked my gym teacher to go get a drink from the water fountain, they just go drink out of the water fountain.
What do the teachers say when that happens?
They really don't care.
That was one of the most emotional moments filming for me, was hearing her. It was a much longer interview than what made the cut. But it was really impactful hearing about what it was like to actually live through it at a school. Like, she talks about how all of the drinking fountains have signs that say do not use or out of order. But sometimes the teachers, I mean, we put a lot of stress on our teachers just normally, but teachers going through a water crisis, trying to corral 20 to 30 kids, you know, sometimes a kid might, you know, drink the water fountain and It's kind of easy because lead is invisible. And, you know, it tastes fine. The water's running clear. You know, maybe you can just shrug that off because you have enough stress in your life. So that's one thing that's really tricky about lead poisoning is that you see images on, you know, Facebook or on YouTube, or you see them in the news about these faucets that are running like completely brown water. And that's not actually the lead. There's a lot going on in Flint other than the lead. But there are people who have, because it's a water-soluble metal, and it completely disappears. It's odorless, it's tasteless, it looks like completely normal water. You can be drinking it for years before you ever think, oh, I'll test this real quick.
Now, Elise, I would be remiss if I didn't also ask you about the trip coming up to Los Angeles when you accept the Student Academy Award. I assume that much of the trip is preparing for your next step after you graduate from MSU in May. You know, plenty of reaching out and networking with the film industry.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've gotten multiple, like, random Facebook messages and emails from people who are like, congratulations, you don't know who I am, but good job. I'm like, this is so strange. I had coffee with Kathleen Glenn a week or two ago, who is Michael Moore's ex-wife and a very prominent producer. And she was talking about how, when you graduate, let me know, because I have some people that I know in New York. And, you know, obviously she's a very deeply connected individual. And the Student Academy Awards also, they make it more of a week-long event. The actual ceremony is 1 week, but I'm going to be there for 5 days before the event. And it's just networking opportunity after networking opportunity. And we were very fortunate. Originally, the Student Academy just flies out the director and puts the director in a hotel. But we were able to ask MSU, ComArts, and Media and Information to help us bring the rest of the crew out. So luckily, all five of us will be representing from Flint out there. It's been really strange, though, you know, kind of thinking about what's next, because it's usually like, oh, I have an exam in a week, instead of, you know, I'm going to have to get a job and survive in the real world.
Yeah. Speaking of getting ready for that next step, I'd love to continue this conversation, but you've got to head off to your internship, which is coming up in a few minutes.
Yeah.
So Elise Conklin, director of From Flint, Voices from a Poisoned City, and recipient this week of a Student Academy Award. Congratulations, and thanks for stopping by to speak with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Great piece, Jamie Paisley with MSU senior Elise Conklin. You can hear Jamie on Classical 90.5 weekday afternoons. Highly recommended. Coming up on the program, the state of the institutional investment at Michigan State University. We'll talk philanthropy with our Vice President for University Advancement, Bob Groves. That's later this hour on Current State from WKAR. My first guest in the studio serves as the Vice President for the Michigan Independent Colleges and Universities, a nonprofit organization dedicated to representing the interests of Michigan's independent, not-for-profit colleges and universities. Peter Spatafore has had a long history of contribution toward educational excellence in Michigan and is currently the president of the Lansing Board of Education. He's a proud alumnus of James Madison College at Michigan State, where he studied social relations and policy with an emphasis on education policy and homeland security studies. Peter Spatafore, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Why education? What fired your passion for promoting and supporting the teaching profession?
You know, it started at a young age, I think. I was in high school and served on the student council, and as part of those roles was I served as the liaison to the school board in our district over at Waverly Community Schools, just down the street here, and gotten pretty involved in that aspect of education, and I thought I could really do this for the rest of my life. But I was afraid of teaching. I didn't think I'd be a good teacher. You know, I really respect our teachers and understand it's not something that everyone can do, and I knew I couldn't do it. So I looked at a way to get involved in education that didn't require me to nervously stand in front of 30 students every day. So policy was where I thought I could really combine my passions for public service and education, and ended up in that field and really have enjoyed it.
Has it turned out to be what you expected?
You know, yes and no. We just passed a big bond in the Lansing School District, and a few weeks ago I had a 45-minute meeting on the height of toilets in the restroom. So that wasn't necessarily anything we covered in any of my policy classes, but it has been rewarding and challenging at the same time.
Talk about the bond issue. I'm fascinated at how you were able to be successful in passing something that equates to a tax increase in a time when people don't like to do that kind of stuff.
Well, you know, that is very interesting. It was an increase, a small increase. We timed it so it would coincide with the expiration of one of our other millages, so it wasn't a large increase. But we needed to go for that increase because we had a sort of a backlog of need in the district, and we're very excited. I mean, 62%, that's not just
that's an affirmation.
By. That's an affirmation. Yeah. That is a mandate. So we're very excited about what that means. When I was running for the board 5 years ago, that was one of my commitments to anyone I talked to was, before I leave, we're going to see shovels in the ground on an infrastructure project that will be far-reaching. And this project is 27 sites ranging from, you know, furniture upgrades to complete building renovations. And, you know, it's not going to fix everything in the district, but it's going to help us implement our new curriculum, which is very exciting. I hear parents very excited about it. Folks taking a second look at Lansing and saying, you know, this is where I want my child to be. This is where I want my kid to learn. So we're very excited about it. We've formed the bureaucracy that's needed to make sure this all happens. We've got committees that oversee spending and plans and things like that. But we will see groundbreaking, hopefully, this fall, or this spring rather, April 2017. So we're very excited about what that might mean for our community.
Tell me more about the curriculum strategy.
Sure. So, you know, I don't know if you're aware, but most people are. In 1994, we changed schooling dramatically in the state of Michigan. We went from, you know, residency-based schools to schools of choice. And a lot of times, the educational institution is hard to respond to those things. And here we are in 2016, where most of our families are making choices about their education, whether they realize it or not, whether they're going to a magnet school or a theme school or down the street to a different school. Parents make choices about their students' education, and doesn't have anything to do particularly with what neighborhood school is in your area. So we looked at our schools and said, how do we develop curriculum pathways that students and families are interested in that have nothing to do with where you live? So we took all of our buildings and we reorganized them into certain blocks of grade ranges based on research and learning skills, and then put in different options like STEM and STEAM and visual performing arts. We've got New Tech High over at Everett. I'm going to go visit them tonight. We've got the International Baccalaureate Academy. It's the only one in mid-Michigan at Eastern. And then Sexton, we're going to ramp up the skilled trades and give students options. You know, we are changing gears in the Lansing School District. When we passed the merit curriculum in the state, it was every kid's going to college. And, you know, I was part of those discussions as a young intern, and it never sat right with me because not every kid wants to go to college. We need to make sure that our schools are preparing our students to be opportunity ready, not just ready for some prescription that we think is right for them. So we think through our custom tailored pathways that students get to choose and navigate with their families and advisors. They will be prepared for those opportunities, no matter what they are.
So how do students and parents decide what their passion is, especially at that early age?
Well, the great thing is every pathway includes comprehensive education. So you're going to get reading, writing, and arithmetic, right? But it allows you to really see what interests you. If you know you want to get your child into the into language, we've got Chinese, Spanish immersion programs that you can put them in at an early age because that's the best time to learn. But the pathways are also fluid to an extent, so you can make different changes. You know, if you want to be in the STEAM program for pre-K through 3, and then you decide visual performing arts 4 through 6, and then international baccalaureate at 7 through 12. You can do all of those things, and we're ramping up our support systems as well to include advisors that will help students and families navigate those decisions. Because obviously, you're not ready to make your life choices at kindergarten for what you're going to do the rest of your life. But the point behind each pathway is it prepares you for whatever's next while engaging you in a relevant curriculum.
You know, a big news story that broke last night, of course, was the violence in New York City. And every time I see that, I think about our schools and what the risks are there. What's going on in that space?
Luckily, we have a really highly trained staff, and we generally proceed through the day without any incident. But one part of the Pathway Promise improvements are hardening our entrances so that folks have to go through the office to check in and go through locked doors and things like that, just to keep our schools just a little safer. Now, we have a very supportive community, a very responsive police department, and our public safety officers are highly trained. So we're ever vigilant, but we're also confident in the safety of our schools.
James Madison College is your alma mater here at Michigan State, and the college has an important birthday coming up. Tell us about how old it was when you came to Michigan State and how old it's going to be.
Well, I was thinking about that recently. We're talking about the 50th anniversary, and I'm on the planning committee for that. And when I got here, I have my T-shirt still that says the 35th anniversary. And I was trying to do the math. And I said, well, I didn't start 15 years ago, and sure enough, I did. So, you know, that's...
Where does time fly?
I know. Last year, I think you all awarded me the Young Alumni Award. And as I said then, it was an honor to be considered young. But it's really putting into context all the great things that Madison has done over the 50 years. You know, we've got 6 Rhodes Scholars and 6 national debate champions. It's wonderful. We've got distinguished alumni like President of the University of Virginia, Terry Sullivan, or the director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Richard Cordray, Eric Schertzing, the Ingham County Treasurer, and then, of course, myself. But
yeah,
it's just a wonderful program. I didn't know anything about it, actually. I wanted to go away to school. Growing up in Lansing, going to East Michigan State, I always was a Spartan through and through, but I wanted to go away, kind of get away from home. And then when I met Madison, I kind of fell in love with the institution and the idea of coming to Michigan State. Ended up in the marching band. It's a great program. You know, it gives you that small college feel on a beautiful Big Ten campus.
And the marching band experience, too. How important was that in your life as a Michigan State Spartan?
You know, very important. I still march with the band to the football games on Saturdays. Most of my very good friends that I still stay in touch with, I met through the marching band. There's nothing like stepping out into Spartan Stadium with a crowd full of fans screaming and playing that fight song for the first time. I recall butterflies. I didn't get sick, but came pretty close to it my first game, but that feeling never goes away.
And what was your instrument?
I played the alto sax.
I'll be darned. That's great. Yes. That's great. Percussionist, one game at Michigan State before work kind of got in the way. The arts is something that always seems to be under attack in school districts. How do we prioritize that?
You make it a priority. You know, we've had some rough financial times over the last few years in the Lansing School District. We have finally come to a point where we're stabilizing our budget. We've balanced our budget every year. We're putting money in the bank. So if we can turn the tide of enrollment back to growth, we will be able to make strong investments. But just recently at the school board table, we and the superintendent agreed that it's time to start looking at expanding those programs for the first time in a long time. You know, we do through the magnet grants and things like that, but we want to make sure that it's a district-wide commitment because, as we talked about earlier, not every kid is going to be this prescription of college graduate or a skilled tradesman or whatever. We want to make sure that they're getting all of the skills.
Why should someone come to Michigan State University? My favorite question.
Oh, man. Well, there's a number of reasons. You know, the dairy store is on the top of the list, but I think it's a wonderful institution with so many options. Just like the Lansing School District, you know, you think of one particular program or something, you know, in our case, it's football and basketball. We've got great programs going on. But if you look at all the different units, all the different colleges on campus, there's so much that's offered here at Michigan State. It was a great experience for me. It's prepared me to do what I'm doing. You know, Spartans doing great things in the world. I run into them all over the place. Anywhere you go, you can see, you know, green and white, and you know you're with family.
Family, that's the magic word. Peter Spadafore is the president of the Lansing School Board, vice president at the Michigan Independent Colleges and Universities, and a proud graduate of MSU's James Madison College. Thanks so much for joining us in the program today.
Thanks.
Always a pleasure. Be safe in India.
Thank you.
Still to come on the program, MSU executive chef Kurt Kwiatkowski talks with Russ White about how to take your tailgating cuisine up a notch this football season. That and more still ahead on Current State from WKAR. Welcome back to Current State on WKAR 90.5 FM, directed by Katie Cook with Drew Hill at the controls. I'm Scott Westerman, sitting in for Mark Bayshore. We're going to be reminding you all throughout this week that our next Pop-Up Stories live storytelling event is Thursday, September 29th. It's at Reach Out Studio Arts Center at 6 p.m. The theme for September is Turning Over a New Leaf. That's appropriate, and we still have room for storytellers. So if you have a five-minute story on that theme and you'd like to participate, email us at currentstate@wkar.org. My next guest on the program is the Vice President for University Advancement at Michigan State. Bob Groves is the head fundraiser for the institution and leads a team of over 200 professionals who are dedicated to identifying and engaging with men and women of vision to invest in the university's future. And a bit of full disclosure, he's also my boss. Bob, welcome to Current State.
Thanks, Scott. Glad to be here.
We're coming off a record fundraising year at MSU. What are the numbers and how did we do it?
Well, last fiscal year, which ended June 30, Michigan State secured $272 million in private support for the university, and we did it with a lot of help. More than 100,000 Spartan alumni, friends, family, including our faculty and staff, have been part of that. We think the Empower Extraordinary campaign that we've been running for several years now is an important part of spreading the word and getting people engaged.
What is the essential message of Empower Extraordinary?
Well, it's basically that Michigan State's a very special place, and we've got a very special mission, and that can't happen without private support. Certainly the support from the state, the tuition that our students pay, the investments that we make through our endowment and other things play a vital role in that. Private support's a really important part of that. An example, every university is no better than the faculty that it has, and Michigan State's got some tremendous faculty. But we're in competition not just with institutions in the state of Michigan or even institutions in the United States, but we're in competition with higher education around the globe for the best and the brightest faculty. Faculty come to be a part of a university not only because of what they're paid, but also because of who their colleagues are and what kind of research they can do and what the caliber of students that are here. So it becomes a very complex mix of how you bring those people here. Endowed faculty support, endowed professorships, endowed chairs are a really important part of that. When we look at how Michigan State stacks up compared to many of our Big Ten peers and top universities around the country, we're behind the curve in terms of the number of endowed chairs. So one of the objectives we set for this campaign was to add 100 new endowed chairs to the university during the life of this campaign. So far, we've added 58 endowed chairs. So making great progress on that goal. I would say when we started this campaign, many of our alumni and many of our best supporters were unaware of that competitive picture and have gotten on board in a big way to help make that happen. An endowed chair is a $2 million endowment, so it's not something that everyone financially can do. But we have many Spartans who can do that if they know the story. So a campaign is also about telling those stories. So that's a venture we've been on for a couple of years now, and we're having some great success.
One of the great storytellers that we have in the campaign is Bob Scandalaris, an amazing Spartan, amazing investor in Michigan State. We've got a clip of him talking about Empower Extraordinary.
Well, there aren't too many places where you can give some money back to a cause and see the direct impact that it has on the people that you most want to help. So you can give to cancer research, and certainly that's a worthy cause. But when we feel like when we give to Michigan State, we can see the benefit it brings to the university and to the environment. And, universities need the support of people out there, whether it's, $100 or $10 million. It doesn't matter. Support, and they need that support.
Really, really good message, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And Bob and Julie have stepped up as leadership donors in this campaign, make personal gifts primarily to athletics, but they've leveraged many, many other donors in that process. So they've helped to many people are familiar that they were lead donors in a previous campaign to the football center But they've also been very important in the expansion of the golf program, including women's golf. So they've been leaders in some of the expansion and renovation going on in the Breslin Center. And there's some announcements coming in the next few weeks about some of that progress. And then Bob and Julie are just tremendous door openers, yeah. Hosts. And Bob and Julie serve as co-chairs of this campaign, along with longtime trustee and great cheerleader for the university, Dee Cook and her husband, Byron. So we're very fortunate to have great, enthusiastic philanthropic leaders. So.
Well, another great clip I want to jump to is Susan Goldberg from National Geographic talking about the campaign.
I thought it was important to establish a scholarship because so many students now are being forced really to take internships in which they are not paid, and that's going to be the only way they can get experience. I have to say I really don't think that's a right thing, but I can't change the world. But what I can do is help those students by, you know, creating a scholarship that will give them stipends so they can take those internships. Otherwise, it would only be wealthy students who could get these internships where they're not paid, when in fact people, you know, lower-income kids, middle-income kids, everybody needs to learn the craft of journalism. And I just think that that needs to be something that everybody can participate in.
Scholarships are really an entry point for many people, aren't they?
Absolutely. And that's the thing people understand most readily and most directly, helping students make sure that they can afford to go to school. And at a time when, you know, the state's literally been disinvesting in higher education for some time, and you know, the university works hard to keep its costs under control and make sure that the university remains affordable. But, you know, you can't work enough hours a day as a student to pay your way through in a given year. When you and I went to college, we could work summer hours and a few hours on the weekends and so forth. I served meals in my fraternity house and paid my room and board that way. And but you can't do that anymore and pay the whole bill. And the alternative is students end up with debt that hangs over them, you know, through a large part of their young career and life. So scholarships are really an important part of making sure that students have that opportunity to come to a place like Michigan State.
Well, you know, the interesting thing to me when we were talking earlier about athletics is the examples that our athletic leadership have made in non-athletic areas. When you look at the gifts from Mark Hollis and Tom Izzo and such, some of it goes to the athletic program, but a lot of it goes elsewhere.
Yeah, well, and they've made a conscious choice in doing that they wanted to send the message that while they're clearly great leaders of athletic programs and they believe in the power of a strong athletic program at a place like Michigan State, they also know that our primary mission is educating young people. And they want that to be part of their message. They want that to be part of their philanthropy. They're here in part because they strongly believe in the power of higher education. Otherwise, we know they've had opportunities to do other things, whether it's professional sports or other areas where their talents would be, you know, more generously compensated. So we're really, really pleased to have them not only as donors but as great ambassadors for Michigan State.
You know, you and I have beginnings in common. You grew up on a farm. My first radio job was reading Hog Prices on WPAG in Ann Arbor, Michigan. How did you find your way from the farm to this profession? What was it that turned you on?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, from that background, I was active like many folks are in things like FFA and 4-H, and that led to some leadership opportunities and a chance to leave the farm and do some public speaking.
Something
and
other
the
than
city.
5 a.m. Yeah. Cow milking.
My dad used to joke that FFA stood for Father Farms Alone. You know, I'd get a chance to travel and to learn more. One of those things led to an opportunity to come back after graduation and work at the university and begin to work in the area of fundraising and alumni relations. I knew a lot of people. I knew the story of why the university was important. I got the chance to talk about how it made a difference in my life. And I was first generation, at least in my immediate family, in terms of going to college. I had an uncle on my mother's side that was college graduate, but that was my sole exposure to higher education. And so it was a bit of a mission for me. I mean, I still believe higher education changes people's lives, and that it's really one of the few things that really does have a transformational impact. And it has that impact, you know, at all kinds of levels. It has that level, that impact on the individual and opening up doors for them, the possibility, but it also has an impact on society and their communities and the way people think and the way they involve other people. So there's a lot of ripples in that pond. And then you begin to understand that particularly in these big public universities that much like the privates, that individual support, that voluntary support, you know, kind of a very American tradition, is a really important part to making these places excellent places. The public's made the possibility here. They've invested in terms of basic facilities and the basic infrastructure. But the difference between an outstanding university and an average university is often that margin that comes from private support. So that was an opportunity for me to use the skills I had in terms of public speaking, public relations, and understanding kind of how the university works to take that to other people. So, and the joy is that there's a lot of great folks, whether it's a Bob and Julie Scandalaris or a Tom Izzo or many, many other alums and friends of the university that believe in that mission as well.
It's a calling. It's very close to a ministerial calling, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, WKAR, we talked at the start of the program about how WKAR kind of has always led the way. Public broadcasting has always been dependent upon philanthropy. Why invest in a place like this today?
Well, it really comes back to that very basic thing of voluntary support. You know, we can fund things lots of ways. We can allow businesses to advertise, and we can simply make it a business of generating income in a very entrepreneurial way. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, but it changes the character of what you do. It means the kind of programs that get covered, the kind of commentary that is held, the kind of way you program is then generated in a way that is designed to deliver optimum dollar support as opposed to the right messages. That's not to criticize our friends in the commercial industry, but
it's an appropriate criticism.
It's a different product, okay? It's a different product. And when you have private support, you're much more free to think widely about how you want to cover the news and how you want to talk about the current events and whether you're going to spend more time going deeply into a subject, even if it might not sell an advertisement or not. If you believe that that's important, then you need to support that with your support. Otherwise, it goes away. And so we're tested in the marketplace every day in a different way. But instead of buying soap, you make a direct contribution. So it's not to denigrate other models, but it's important to have those alternatives. And that's why, you know, I personally support, you know, public radio, public broadcasting, because it's important to me. Some people may choose not to do that, but you can't have it both ways. You can't complain about what the alternatives are and then not be participating in a way to help it. So.
Amen. Spoken like two of us who are investors in this very fine radio station. Bob Groves is a vice president for university advancement at Michigan State University. Boss, thank you for being on the
Thanks,
program
Scott.
Today. It's been an honor to have
it's
you.
It's nice
here.
To know you have marketable skills.
It's always a plan B. The program is Current State on WKAR. That's Kathy Zell in the control room, our lead fundraiser here at 90.5 FM. Thank you for your work. Tailgating season is heating up, and the Spartan throngs are set to enjoy another beautiful Spartan Saturday on the banks of the Red Cedar. This Saturday, when Wisconsin comes to town, Current State's Russ White caught up with MSU corporate chef Kurt Kwiatkowski to find out how tailgating has changed over the years.
I think it's definitely changed, especially over the past maybe 5-7 years. Tailgating's become so much more intricate. It's like a destination. Before, it used to be you roll up, you got a cooler, you open it up, you got a couple of sandwiches and maybe some chips out of a bag, and you're done. Nowadays, it's so much more intricate, and people are there for, you know, the 4 to 6 to 8 hours before and after. And the food quality level has really gone really high, too.
So I think some of the tips are, how do I keep the hot stuff hot, keep the cold stuff cold before and after, as you said, and keep it simple.
Yeah, and keeping it simple and trying not to overthink it. And to me, it's all about the prep ahead. Like if you're going to do brats, simmer them off before. And because part of being at the tailgate is having some fun with your friends. So if you simmer off the brats ahead of time, then all you have to do is grill them off. You simmer them off at home, cool them down, leave them in a little bit of liquid, get them in a plastic Ziploc bag so it doesn't take up as much room. And then when you get there, you can just start popping brats out left and right, and you're good to go. That's one of my personal faves, you know, just a really, really good brat with some caramelized onions. It's kind of heavenly. Or even just some grilled onions, you know, with some nice spicy mustard. People that do pulled pork, you can do that up ahead, and then you can just have your grill set up, and you can kind of just warm it up on that grill while you're there. Just make sure it's got a little bit of extra liquid to it. Cooking out there, really the only thing you're going to want to maybe cook are warm up some hot dogs, maybe cook a couple of burgers. Even if you wanted to do ribs, do up the ribs ahead, cool them down, and then finish them, because you're always going to finish them on the grill and kind of sauce them afterwards, and that's the best way to go.
What about safety, Kurt, too? We're talking about a long tailgating day. We want the food to stay safe.
Yeah, you know, have that one cooler that's got extra ice in it. And you can even, like, even at Meijer here locally, you can buy a little chunk of dry ice and keep a small piece in that cooler to keep it super cold, and keep your proteins in one cooler, and then keep your veggies and or whatever else, your drinks, in another cooler, and keep them separated, and try and keep that cooler as shut as possible and only go into it when you need to grab something. And that idea of cooking to order or cooking to flow like you do in a restaurant, kind of do it for the tailgate. Don't just cook as soon as you get there and everything's up and for 4 hours it's sitting there. Not the best way to go. You just cook as people want to eat, and it works out a lot better, and I think the food's going to taste a lot better as well.
And what about a couple of your favorite recipes, Kurt, or things you like to have at a tailgate?
Yeah, definitely one of my faves is a brat. I'm also a big fan of anything pork-related, so a nice rib. Friends of mine, even like some beef brisket as always, because you can smoke it and then just kind of warm it up when you're there, slice it, put it on a piece, you know, a nice little roll. It's kind of heavenly.
And Kurt, there's a lot of good food that you and your colleagues have inside the stadium now. You can get more than a brat and a hot dog there, too. What's new this year? And update people that still may not know about the delicacies you provide in the stadium.
Yeah, everything from the beefsteak, Spartan beefsteak, in that new north end zone that was renovated and open. We've got a huge venue where we're doing what we call the Spartan beefsteak. So it's kind of like your Philly with your beef and the cheese melted right in front of you with the peppers and onions right on the grill. It's delicious. A beefsteak nacho that we do. The pulled pork we do in the stadium at Smokestack Barbecue is just, it's so popular we now have three locations for it. And the pulled pork nachos are probably one of my favorites in the stadium. And we also added walking taco. So the good old classic walking taco, but instead of the trying to get your spoon into the bag and deal with it, we found some bags from Fritos where you rip the bag on the side. And then we pour in the chili that we make and all the toppings that go on it, the cheese and the onions, and it's really a killer dish.
So Chef Kurt, summarize for our listeners again your key kind of tips for a simple but still delicious and safe tailgating experience.
Sure, I think preparation ahead of time, that prep and pre-planning ahead is really important. Keep it in small bags, keep things iced down really well, and keep it simple. Really just keep it simple, because that perfectly cooked brat off the grill kind of as you're going along, instead of something that's been sitting there for 5 or 6 hours, is going to be so much better. Even if you just got a little spicy mustard with it, it's going to be so much better, and you're going to enjoy the tailgate that much more. You really will.
Kurt Kwiatkowski is the corporate chef for MSU in the Residential and Hospitality Services Unit. He's better known as Chef Kurt, and you can keep up with him on Twitter simply at Chef_Kurt. That's Kurt with a K, K-U-R-T. I'm Russ White for Current State on WKAR.
Join Russ White for MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 on AM 870, and you can hear his long-form conversations anytime at SpartanPodcast.com. And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, something I'm very interested in. Album covers used to get almost as much attention as the music inside. The Keys to Creativity Gallery in the Lansing Mall marks the golden age of album art from 1967 to 1983, with an exhibit through October 6th. Current State Scott's Bowl will has a look. That and more Wednesday on Current State. I'm wondering if I'm going to see Sergeant Pepper, Abraxas, Dark Side of the Moon, all that good stuff. Should be fun. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed our show today. Don't forget that one. Also, thanks to Jamie Paisley for a fantastic interview. Kevin Lavery, Scott Pohl, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill also contribute to the program. The Current State podcast is your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. From politics to education, environmental news to healthcare, science and tech to music and theater. Stories from around the state in your hometown. That's the Current State podcast. Anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay connected with Current State on Twitter, KAR Current State, and on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. I hope you'll join us tomorrow right here on WKAR for Current State.